It's my pleasure to introduce our last speaker for the day. He works at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture in Iowa, named after Aldo Leopold, a famous naturalist. You might have heard of the Sand County Almanac. The idea of integrating ecological ideas and working across disciplines really is a reflection of what we were trying to do with this symposium. There's lots of separate concepts of what health is, human health, environment health. And the concept of One Health, I'm not sure. I was unfortunately able to be here for the first talks, but hopefully that was mentioned to you as well, how we can learn from each other what these concepts are. And so Fred is going to be giving the closing talk in a radical departure from standard talks. He is not going to have a PowerPoint. So synthesizing ideas for health and for us this afternoon, Dr. Fred Kirschenlund.
Thank you very much, Lisa, and a couple of things. First of all, so that those of you who don't know, I'm not a soil scientist. My academic career was in philosophy, so I'm a person who likes to think about big picture issues, and probably one of the reasons that I was invited to do this closing talk. And my the other part of my diverse career was in farming. I actually have a farm in North Dakota, which I still provide some management services for. And mostly what I learned about soil, I learned from my own farm. And that had a profound effect on me. And so part of what I want to share with you this afternoon is based on those experiences. But the title that I've chosen for my talk is from Sir Albert Howard, and Eric this morning did a great job of pointing out the history of all of the people that have been engaged in this relationship of soil health and human health. And Sir Albert Howard had a profound effect on me because when I was looking at our own farming operation and trying to figure out back in the 1970s what direction we should take our farm, and began to become aware of the fact that some of the difficulties from the intensive input system that we had on our own farm, and as we tried to project those into the future, they just didn't look to me like they were going to be, quote, sustainable. So we converted our farm to an organic farm, and it's still being managed as an organic farm today. Now, I'm not quite as enthusiastic as Pat is about organic farming because I think there are different, and you, one of the things I liked about one of your lines was well-managed organic farms. And as I think all of us who have been involved know that there are some organic farms that are not that well-managed. They simply use natural inputs instead of synthetic inputs, and then soil health sometimes is not included in that. But the thing about Sir Albert Howard was that, he was one of the early thinkers about how we do agriculture. And primarily, he spent most of his life in India on a research farm that he was managing there. And as he told his story, he actually learned a lot of things about how to farm appropriately from the farmers than he did from his own, research, et cetera. But so he created this research farm based on a notion of farming the way nature would farm. How would nature do this? Because he began to realize that the kind of direction that modern agriculture was going in, which was to a large extent stimulated by Justus von Liebig, who had done research and then developed a paper in which he pointed out that we needed to look at the law of the minimum. What's the least that we can put in order to get the most out of it that we want? And the best way to do that is to put in those primarily nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, but, you know, a couple of other things as well. And we saw the lists today of those kinds of things we need to think about. But what Justus von Liebig came up with was that farmers didn't have to go through all this laborious process of managing their soil for soil health. All they needed to do was put in these inputs, and they would get all of the yields that they wanted, etc. And, of course, that to a large extent proved true. But Justus von Liebig, Sir Albert Howard, when he looked at that and looked at his own experience in India of trying to figure out how to manage a farm that was as sustainable as possible, he knew that this was the wrong direction. He referred to it, in fact, as the NPK mentality. And he referred to that ultimately as a form of banditry because it was going to steal healthy soil from future generations. And this was not a direction that we should go in. So the title from my talk I borrowed from Sir Albert Howard, and he did two books early on. One was called The Waste Products of Agriculture, which was published in 1931, where he was trying to point out what are some of the waste products that we can use to sustain our farming systems. And then the second, which was probably a more important book, was an Agriculture Testament, which he published in 1940. In which he laid out what a farming system that operates the way nature would farm is like. And if you haven't ever looked at it, you might want to, on page 4, he has a short summary in which he summarizes in a single paragraph what agriculture would look like if we farmed like nature. And the first line is, Mother Earth never farms without livestock. So animals are always part of the system. Mother Earth always farms with a diversity of plants, so there are no monocultures. And he goes on, there's no waste. And he goes on with that whole list. And this is the way farming should be done, and that's radically different. And then in 1947, he published a third book, which was mentioned earlier today, which he called The Soil and Health, in which he made the assertion that if we don't have healthy soil, then you can't have healthy plants or healthy animals, and ultimately can't have healthy humans. And so he made this statement, healthy soil, healthy plants, healthy animals, healthy humans are all one subject, all one great subject, and you can't separate them. So I used that for the title of my talk because I think that one of the things that we have an incredible opportunity now, and incidentally, I want to thank Lisa and others who put this project together this afternoon, because, you know, I think it was about 20 years ago, two of my friends who are soil scientists submitted a proposal to do a workshop at this conference on soil health, and they were turned down because, as the evaluators said, soil health doesn't have anything to do with soil science, and we're about soil science. So we've come a long way, Lisa. but the reason that I think that all of this is so important is because we are at a point now where we have some serious difficulties, not only in agriculture but also in healthcare. And I think that the proposal that Sir Albert Howard made, which was that we need to think about farming like nature, and that we need to look at how we can do this in a way so that we can not only have soil health but also have human health. And but he made the observation when he published this book that we don't have the data yet about. In other words, he was making these assertions based on his own observations on his own farm, etc. And one example that he used, just as an example, was that, you know, back then in India, they still used oxen as one of the primary, means of energy for the farm. And so he had oxen on his farm, which he had fenced off, where he, of course, managed for soil health. And but there were oxen that were also outside of his farm. And this was back when hoof and mouth disease was still pretty prevalent. And he made the observation that often his oxen would rub noses with the oxen on the outside who had hoof and mouth disease, but his oxen never got hoof and mouth disease. And his conclusion was the reason for that is because his oxen were feeding on healthy plants from healthy soil and had built their natural immunities in a way that they didn't get, that they didn't acquire those diseases. Now, he made an interesting observation, however, in his book. He said that his idea of this connection between soil health and plant health and animal health and human health was what he called a boldly revised point of view, and it would need to be fully researched, quote unquote, with entirely fresh investigations. Now, one of the reasons that Sir Robert Howard is such an important figure for me in all of this is because this is something we haven't done yet. We yet, after all of this time, so far as I know, have not done the kind of peer-reviewed research that demonstrates that this is, in fact, all one subject. And one of the reasons that that's so important is because, well, first of all, one is that the question about whether or not we know what soil health is about and how to measure it, et cetera, is no longer a question. And if you think it still is, I would recommend to your reading soil health manual that Cornell University has put out now. And this was this edition was the second edition in 2009, and they're in the process of putting together a revised edition, which Harold Van Ness, who incidentally I'm thrilled to say has been selected as the president-elect for the Soil Science Society for 2016, right? And he is, in my view, one of our more creative soil scientists, but he's one of the scientists that put this document together, which is entitled the Cornell Soil Health Assessment Training Manual. And anybody that thinks that soil health is still not a scientifically verifiable document should look at this, because there is no way anymore that anyone can question whether or not we can scientifically determine what soil health is about and how to measure it. And so we have all of this that's happening. Soil health is now, and you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, soil health was hardly ever mentioned in the literature. Now it's almost in everything. Everything that I read has to do with agriculture. People are talking about soil health. So it's now a part of our culture. It's now a part of the way we think about it. But the other thing that's important about this is that not only do we now know what soil health is, and it's now accepted in our general literature and in our thinking and in our research, but we also know that that we have some difficulties in terms of our healthcare system. You know, Jock Heron, who is a design specialist at Harvard University, in fact, pointed out to me that there is a very interesting contrast between what's happened to our cost of food and what's happened to our cost of healthcare. And as he points out, back in 1930, we were spending 25% of our personal disposable income on food, and now we're spending a little less than 10%. So we have this consistently decreasing cost of food as we in our food system. But then when you look on the other side, when you look at our cost of healthcare, we were spending 5.2% of our GDP on healthcare in 1960, and we're now spending 18%. So those costs have consistently gone up. Now, Jock is the first person to say, I'm not saying that it was exactly the cheap food, which is all of the cost of our healthcare, but you also can't say there isn't some connection here. And he also points out that if these trends of increasing cost in healthcare continue to go up as they are, then by around the year 2050, it'll be 25% of GDP. And he points out that from his analysis as a design specialist, that you can't have a healthcare system that costs 25% of GDP and still have a functioning economy. So we have to do something about this. So here's the issue. Isn't this a good time now that we understand the meaning of soil health and it's acceptable? We understand that our healthcare system is broken. In fact, one other resource that I want to call to your attention is a couple of people who've written this book called Creating Wealth. So this is about wealth. And they have some very creative ideas about what we need to do in order to have a sustainable wealth system. Holdsmith and Letier, and they have a chapter in the middle of their book entitled Putting the Care Back into Healthcare. And one of the things they mention, they said, you know, if we look at our healthcare system, we don't have a healthcare system, we have a sickness care system. We put very little of our effort and our innovation and our work into keeping people healthy. We wait until they're sick, and then we put all of our efforts into trying to deal with their sickness. Now, that's not true of many of our public health institutions, like the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health that we heard from earlier today, who have begun to move in this direction. But here's the other thing that's interesting to me, is that we now have not only people in agriculture, but also people in our healthcare professions who are starting to look at these linkages between soil health and human health. And let me just give you a couple of examples. Daphne Miller, who is a family physician in California, runs her own clinic, but also teaches family medicine at the University of California. And she's written a couple of books now. One is called Pharmacology, spelled F-A-R-M, not P-H-A-R-M, as you would probably expect from a healthcare professional. And her whole book is about how she learned how to be a more effective healthcare professional from farmers who practice integrated pest management. Now, what's integrated pest management? Well, I'm certainly everybody in this room knows that, you know, in integrated pest management, you don't wait until the pests emerge and then go in with a pesticide to get rid of the pest. You try to manage the natural system in such a way that the pests don't emerge, right? And then she looked at that, and after talking with a number of farmers doing this, said, that's how we ought to do healthcare. You know, instead of waiting until people get sick, we ought to be managing things in a way that keep them healthy to begin with. And so so she has now been practicing her medicine and increasingly and looking at this in terms of what is it that we need to do to keep people healthy. And she's become increasingly convinced that one of the things is to grow the food that people eat on healthy soil. Because she, based on her own experience as a physician, is confirming what Sir Albert Howard said, that if you have healthy soil, you're going to have healthy plants, healthy animals, and therefore it's going to contribute to healthy food. And she published a short article in Yes Magazine here just a couple of months ago, and in which she now has made this case directly, that based on her experience now, she is saying that that soil health is critical to achieving the kind of healthcare systems that we need. So there's also, let me just give you one other example. I could give you some others, but there's one of those, a physician in New Jersey by the name of Ron Weiss. And he used to run a clinic where he practiced medicine like most people do, you know, waiting until people get sick and then try to get them help. And then he finally realized that this was not the right way to do things. And so he created a new organization for himself, which he calls the Ethos Health Community, where he's put together a farm of I think it's 238 acres, where he grows the food that he thinks people ought to eat if they're going to be healthy, and then makes that food available. And this is now the primary way in which he is investing his time and his energy. So my reason for saying all of this is I think we're at a very important place right now where we have an opportunity to do the kind of research that Sir Albert Howard said we need to do that we haven't, that way back when he wrote his book in 1947, that we still haven't done. We have an opportunity to do this now, because we have people in the soil sciences who understand the importance of soil health, and we have an increasing number of people in the healthcare professions who are beginning to recognize that relationship between soil health and human health. So can't we now begin to have put together an interdisciplinary research team that would do the research that either proves that Sir Albert Howard was right or that points out that he wasn't right? This is an important piece of information that we need now, particularly as we begin to address the future challenges with regard to both agriculture and healthcare that we have in front of us. So my suggestion is, and my call to action is, that soil scientists begin to reach out now to healthcare professionals who both begin to recognize that this is an important piece of research that we should be doing, and then put that research together. And I think that, again, the timing for this is good, because I think that if you look at the mission of the National Institute for Health, it's exactly along these lines, figuring out how we can begin to have a better healthcare system that keeps people healthy. This is a part of their mission. So I think that they would be receptive to a proposal by soil scientists and healthcare professionals who begin to who put together a proposal that says this is a linkage that we need to do some peer-reviewed research on now. To demonstrate, because if it proves to be true, then we can in fact begin to move in a direction in which we not only have a better agriculture, but also a better healthcare system. And so that's my challenge to all of you. I also want to indicate that there's one other area where we're starting to see these kinds of connections, and that's with chefs and soil quality. And Dan Barber, who is one of our celebrity chefs, happens to be a good friend of mine. He is now, after 20 years of trying, and of course as a chef, the things he's most interested in is the best tasting food that he can possibly serve in his restaurant. And he's discovered after 20 years that the best way to guarantee that is to get the food that he buys from farmers who are managing their soil for soil health. And he's not just talking about organic farms, he's talking about managing for soil health. And one of the things he's discovered, that if he gets the food from farmers who manage their soil for soil health, then all he needs to do as a chef is to prepare the food in the way that allows the natural flavors to express themselves. He doesn't have to do all the manipulation that many chefs do to try to get the, and put in a lot of sugar and other things, which we know has some health care consequences. So if this is working for chefs, and it's beginning to work for healthcare professionals, I think that the timing, given all of the things that I've mentioned, couldn't be better for us to do this kind of research now. And so I would encourage any of you in this room who are soil scientists to reach out to healthcare professionals. And we have, you know, a representative here from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And I don't want to predict for you, but I would guess that the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health would be very interested in looking at this kind of collaborative research project. And this could then, we could, in, this is a 5-year research project, a 3-year research project, you know, I don't know. But at some point in the not too distant future, we could have reports back at this conference to provide the results from that kind of research, which I think would be extremely important for us. So let me also call your attention to one other new book, which just came out by David Montgomery and his wife, Ann Bickley. The title of it is The Hidden Half of Nature. And this is one of the best books that I've read about where we are at now in terms of the microbial life and the microbiome, not only in soil, but also, you know, in ourselves. And David Montgomery, as I'm sure most of you know, is one of our, from my point of view at least, one of our leading soil scientists, and he's published several books. But in this book, what he points out, what he means by the hidden half of nature, is that until very recently, we have not paid the kind of attention to the microbial life in both in soil and in ourselves. And this is now something that we're beginning to explore and understand, and their whole book is about their own experience in this, including their work in their own garden. And this is a great book for students because it's not highly technical, but it lays it out just very, very clearly. And let me just give you as an example, toward the end of the book, the last chapter is about the implications for health, for our health. And then there's a summary paragraph near the end which kind of gives you an idea of why this book excites me. They say, so where does this revolutionary new perspective leave us? put bluntly, many practices at the heart of modern agriculture and medicine, two arenas of applied science critical to human health and well-being, are simply on the wrong path. We need to learn how to work with rather than against the microbial communities that underpin the health of both people and plants. So I just got my copy last week. It was scheduled to come out in November, and here we are. And it's available now, and I would highly recommend it to anybody that's interested in this topic. It's a very inspiring book. So where do we go from here, Lisa? There's this new direction now, which we're all reading about with genetic engineering, with the CRISPR kind of thing, and we're now figuring out that, there are a lot of things we can do that we didn't know we could do before, and we can make these significant changes. And there have also been some, from my perspective, important cautions being raised about that, because this really puts us in a position as human beings now to determine the direction of evolution. And is that really, are we really ready to do that? That's an important question, I think. But aside from that, wherever that's going to take us, I think that, to me, one of the most important papers that I've read in all of this, and it wasn't specifically about genetic engineering, it was about pest management. And it was an article written by Joe Lewis and his colleagues, who at that time were the head of the pest management system at the Agriculture Research Service. And that paper was published in 1997 in the National Academy of Sciences Proceedings. And what they point out was after, 40 years of their experience in pest management, was they said, we now know that what they call single-tactic therapeutic intervention approaches are not sustainable. What they meant by that is you wait until the pests emerge, and then you come in with a pesticide from outside to get rid of them, right? That's the single-tactic therapeutic intervention. And they said, we now know this is not sustainable. Why? Because in the first place, you never get rid of all of the target pests, so you create pest resistance. And secondly, you don't only harm the target pest, you also harm some other pests. You also harm some other biological organisms, some of which previously helped to keep the pests, in check. So you're actually creating part of the problem you're trying to solve. And then they said, what we need to do now is transition from this single-tactic therapeutic intervention strategy to what they called natural systems management. How do we manage complex systems in a way to prevent pests from emerging rather than doing it all in terms of single-tactic therapeutic intervention? And then they had a couple of paragraphs in that article, which I thought were very important, which addresses your question. It said, we should not expect any different results from biological technology than we did from chemical technology. This is still the same paradigm. And this is exactly to me personally, the issue is not so much genetic engineering, it's how we're using it, how we're applying it. It's still you know, single tactic, therapeutic intervention strategies to solve the problem. And certainly every farmer knows now the resistance problem is, there's a lot of our pest management specialists who are saying that, you know, if we don't change the way in which we're doing this, then give it another 2 or 3 years, and then Roundup, for example, is going to become dysfunctional because simply everything's going to be resistant to it. So those are some of the kinds of things that I think we have to look at. Again, the issue is not so much the specific technology. The issue is how we're managing complex systems. And the other thing that Joe Lewis and his colleagues said in there, which I always liked, that they, near the end of the article, they say, what we need to do now is to ask a different question. Instead of asking, how do we get rid of the pest, what we should be asking is, why is the pest a pest? And I think the same thing, and they also made an implication in that article, this wasn't just about pest management, it was about, you know, the way in which we manage systems throughout, whether it's healthcare or anything else. And so I think that's the key thing. You know, we have to start recognizing, as Aldo Leopold did already back in the 1940s, that we humans are not the conquerors of what he called the land community, by which he meant the entire biotic community and all of its complexity. We are not the conquerors. We're simply plain members and citizens. So we need to operate in a way, how do you maintain the health of the whole, and we being a part of that? And that, again, is why I think what we're talking about here in this session this afternoon is so important.
So,
I'm a Russian-German, so I haven't had a good day unless I had at least one argument. I haven't had one yet today. So, if you disagree with something I said, you know, let's. Yeah, and I think, you know, this is one, I had a note, when I didn't go into it, I didn't want to take more time, but one of the other issues that I think is so important in our culture is, and I'm not opposed to reductionism, I think reductionism plays an important role, and having separate disciplines that really bore down on issues within a particular discipline are important, but I think that the unintended consequence from that is we all tend to begin operating our own separate silos, and so we aren't looking at, and the world doesn't operate in separate silos, it operates in terms of complex interactions, and so we need to begin to have some cross-disciplinary kinds of engagement, and I always try to look for a little bit of good news, and one of the really good news parts about this at Iowa State University is that the graduate program for sustainable agriculture, which was designed primarily by Matt Liebman, who is one of the leaders in the kind of thinking about these more diverse kinds of approaches. And so they designed that program as a transdisciplinary program. Now, students still come into the program through a discipline, through sociology or economics or agronomy or whatever, but once they're in the program, they're all in it together, and they wrestle with these kinds of problems, et cetera, that we're dealing with here from the point of view of these transdisciplinary interactions. And it's a very exciting thing to see how it develops, and I have to tell you that from my prejudiced point of view, at least, the graduates from that program are now producing a different caliber of people into our society, and they I think are going to provide some very important kinds of leadership for all of us. But this is, I think this is an important part of that addresses your question. Yeah. Yes?
So, Fred, something about the, you know, meshing disciplines, and it's just a challenge, is the timeline that we're dealing with. Well, for one, a lot of health studies, the end point is mortality, and that's a long time. I mean, these crop studies that started in the 1800s, you know, you, if you want to look at mortality, you could start with folks who are born in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. So mortality is a really hard endpoint to look at practices in a narrow time range. Morbidity or disease is, yeah, it's a little bit easier. The morbidity endpoints that we like to look at are things that a lot of people get, like cancers, heart disease, short-term respiratory distress, or it's just hard to find the right endpoint with the right population size that's affected. And another issue, just to note some differences, is that a lot of the health-based work is risk-based. So we want to reduce risks. And a lot of the work I'm hearing from the soil community is make soils healthier, add all these benefits to soils. So how do we look at an agricultural system that's geared towards improvements, benefits, with outcomes that are risk-based or reducing risk, not necessarily geared towards observing benefits? I think it's very hard to observe benefits.
So I'm not quite clear what the major point of, I mean,
well,
I agree with all of that.
There are two issues, is that the timeline for the health side of the studies, you know, it's hard to get a big sample size, a large enough population of people affected by a particular
agriculture. Oh, you mean in terms of designing the research?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to operate on the assumption that if soil scientists and healthcare professionals get together to design this research, they'll come up with a way to deal with that. Because I do think that we have, I am very impressed with people who design research projects. And, you know, depending on what the research they are after, you know, their ability to design that in ways that, that, you know, that get published in Science Magazine, et cetera, it's a, Pat was arguing earlier, so that I think that we can come up with a way to design that can, and again, maybe this isn't a research project that's going to be just one project. Maybe this is going to be a research effort, you know, that will, you know, as we all know, science is not a collection of accumulated facts. It's a process, and so this will be a process as well. But at least if we can get together and decide this is important enough to do it, I think it's going to make a huge contribution to,
But it's not totally not doable. You're talking about healthier soils versus risk, right? So, I mean, the health community looks at studies all the time that say, does increased dosage of this drug help reduce the risk of some sort of disease, right? So do healthier soils,
I think one of the other things that we need to look at, and this is a little more controversial, but, I really agree with Tom's presentation this morning about all the nasty things that can be in soil that we have to be careful about. And so, the whole concept that we have this nature deficit disorder because we haven't been in nature enough, which I agree with, but we also have to be very careful about that reconnection with nature, because, you know, for what, a couple of generations now, our whole emphasis has been to keep to protect us from the microorganisms, right? Because somehow they were all considered to be, you know, if you get exposed to this and you don't wash your hands adequately, and I'm not saying we shouldn't wash our hands, but then somehow you're going to get sick from that. And so we all want to keep ourselves as clean as possible. Well, one of the things that we know now as we better understand how the microbiome works is that if you don't get exposed to some of those microbes that are threatening to other microbes in your body, then they don't build their natural immunities. And then you become more vulnerable to sickness. So we have to figure out how to regain our relationship with soil as we go through this process of building our natural immunities again, which I think is part of the maintaining health issue. And that's going to be a rather tricky process because of, you know, all the things that Tom mentioned to us this morning about all the nasty things that are, especially in the way in which we've managed soil, that are in our soil now. So you don't want to just send your kids out into the soil assuming that's going to make them healthy. But we already know, and again, this is not my area of expertise, but some of my friends in the healthcare profession tell me that there's an increasing awareness now that when women give birth to a child and they can't do it naturally, they have to do a C-section, that the child, the birth then from the C-section is not exposed to some of the microbes in the vagina of the mother, and so they're now trying to figure out how to get that to the newborn baby, you know, so it has builds those natural immunities. So, you know, my God, if that's true, then what about, you know, what about the rest of life that we're involved in, you know?
We have time for one more point of interest.
I was wondering if one way to get this kind of research really off to a quick start is to look into hepatophagia, eating soil.
Oh.
And I believe there is some work on hepatophagia in a modern context.
Uh-huh. Well, another great idea, I think.
Sure, it's healthy soil.
I think one of the things that, and here's where I think my final comment is, I think the arts can play a significant role in all of this, because you know, I think we've pretty much in our culture convinced ourselves that this you know, consumptive society that we've been in, where we all wanna you know, get our food as cheaply as possible so that we can buy more stuff. And that somehow that increases our quality of life. Well, there's now a number of psychological studies which have indicated that's actually not true. Our quality of life now is actually worse. Our rates of depression are higher. Our rates of anxiety are higher. Our rates of suicide are higher ever since we've been on this, you know, this consumptive lifestyle. And so the arts can, I think, help us imagine a better life than what we currently have that's based on the kinds of principles we've talked about here. And one of the things in terms of that I like in terms of the arts and soil is Deborah Kunz Garcia's Symphony of Soil. If some of you have not seen that,
shown here. It was the ASA presented it.
Oh, they did? Okay, all right. Well, I've always said that nobody can see the Symphony of Soil and still think that soil's just dirt. And that's a step in the right direction for getting people to appreciate the role that soil plays and the importance of role. And so Deborah has given us a great example of how the arts can be used in that way, and bringing the science into it. You know, also this is one of the other things we talk about. And I was so glad that we both talked about soil loss and soil erosion and soil degradation today, because those are two very different things, but both equally important. But the thing is, if we lose soil, soil is not a renewable. Calorie, because you know, soil, as Deborah Kunz Garcia's documented points out, you know, soil on this planet developed over thousands, in some cases millions of years. So you can't lose that and then just replace it. It's a non-renewable resource. But degradation of soil is a renewable resource, because if you still have soil there, we know what we can do to restore the biological health of the soil. I mean, that's all pretty clear now. So it's important to keep those two distinctions too as we think about soil. Soil loss is a loss, say essentially forever. Soil degradation, we know how to do that. But in order to be able to restore the health of soil, you still have to have soil there. That's, you know. So, and the reason this is so important is because, you know, according to some recent studies that have pointed out in Iowa, for example, we've lost essentially half of our topsoil since 1960. This is one of the richest soil deposits in the world. You know, and you know, we can't just, you know, turn our backs on that and say, well, you know, it's just what farmers have to do. And I'm not blaming the farmers; it's our whole system. So we have to work on this together and recreate a whole new paradigm that's based on regenerative resilient, and relationships. Those are the three R's I think are the most important now. Because you can't just tell farmers they got to change or tell eaters they got to change. We got to change the system that enables everybody to move in these new directions. So,
thank you very much.